Udame Research, Algorithms for Life. Today, we are taking an exhaustive deep dive into, well, one of the greatest paradoxes in modern learning and education.
Yeah, we're talking about spaced repetition systems, or SRS.
Exactly. These are the algorithms, the engines, that are designed to work with the biology of our memory, not against it.
And the sources we're looking at today, they run the gamut. I mean, we've got everything from molecular neuroscience all the way up to huge data sets on user retention.
And they all point to this stunning contradiction.
On the one hand, you have a learning science that is, for all intents and purposes, universally accepted.
Absolutely. The simple act of spacing out your learning over time it's a fundamental principle of how we consolidate memory. It's biologically mandatory.
And we have, what, over 140 years of evidence backing this up? It's not a new idea.
And the power of that science is just immense. We're looking at a landmark meta-analysis, one that pulled together the results of 317 separate experiments.
317, that's a huge sample.
And it found that spaced practice produces an astounding 74% better retention than cramming.
74%. I mean, think about that. That's not a small difference. That is a life-changing improvement in efficiency.
It really should be the gold standard for anyone trying to learn, well, anything.
But then, you know, we crash right into reality.
Yeah, the real world.
Despite this incredibly robust scientific foundation, despite all the sophisticated apps, the implementation of SRS, it's just failing dramatically.
The numbers are shocking. Our sources point to two statistics that are, frankly, deeply concerning.
The first one is that only 0.1%, that's 0.1% of Duolingo users ever complete a course.
It's basically a rounding error. And the second one?
Education apps as a whole, as a category, have the absolute lowest user retention rates of any mobile category, a dismal 1.76%.
So we know how memory works. The math is getting better and better. And yet the user base just collapses almost immediately.
Its success rate is effectively zero.
So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack that exact paradox. We're going to start at the molecular level to see why spacing is non-negotiable.
Then we'll move through the algorithmic arms race, you know, this quest to perfectly predict forgetting.
And finally, we're going to confront the systemic conflicts, the economics of engagement versus the science of durable knowledge. That's really where the rubber meets the road.
Exactly. We're not just asking if spacing works. We know it does. We're asking why, when you put it in an app, it fails to keep 99.9% of people engaged.
To really get why the technology is failing, you have to first understand the biology it's tuning to serve.
Mm-hmm. We have to start inside the neuron, at the cellular level.
Right. Let's talk about the molecular requirement, why spacing isn't just a good idea, but a biological mandate.
When people talk about spacing, it often sounds like, you know, just another study tip, a pedagogical preference.
Nice to have.
Exactly. But the research is emphatic on this point. If you want to form a long-term memory, the timing of your learning is not optional. It is absolutely required by your biology.
And to see why, we need to look at two specific proteins that are essentially acting as molecular timekeepers in the brain.
The first, and you could argue it's the most important one, is a protein called C-EB.
Okay, and C-EB stands for?
It's a mouthful. Cyclic AMP response element binding protein.
Right. Let's just stick with C-EB.
I think so, yeah. And you can think of C-EB as nothing less than a molecular switch inside the neuron.
A switch.
Yeah. The level of C-EB activation is what determines whether the electrical activity of learning, which, you know, creates a short-term memory, gets converted into the actual structural and chemical changes that are necessary for a long-term memory.
So if C-EB flips the switch on, the memory is built to last.
Exactly.
But if it doesn't get flipped, the memory is temporary. It's just doomed to fade away.
Precisely. And the classic illustration of this comes from a place you might not expect. Studies on fruit flies. Drosophila melanogaster.
Okay, so what did they do with these fruit flies?
They gave them identical training. 10 trials where an odor was paired with a small electric shock. The goal was to teach them to avoid a specific smell.
And I'm guessing they tried two different schedules.
They did. First, they used a mass training schedule. All 10 trials were delivered back to back in rapid succession with no rest periods in between.
The fruit fly equivalent of cramming for an exam.
That's a perfect analogy. And it worked in the short term. The flies learned to avoid the odor, but that memory only lasted for about 3 days.
So the short-term memory formed just fine.
It did. But the long-term changes, the things that make a memory permanent, they never fully solidified. They forgot quickly because that C-EB switch wasn't thrown all the way.
But then they introduced spacing. And this is where it gets really revolutionary.
It is. Their researchers kept the amount of training identical. Still 10 trials, but they space them out with just a 15-minute interval between each one.
Just 15 minutes.
Just 15 minutes. And that simple change in timing fundamentally changed the outcome.
The memory lasted longer.
Much longer. It generated a robust, long-term memory that lasted for 7 days or more. Now, for a fruit fly with a lifespan of about 50 days, that is a huge difference.
It's a difference between learning a skill for a week versus having a little trick that just vanishes in 3 days.
And the volume of input was identical. The timing was the only variable, but it dictated the entire durability of the memory.
And they went one step further to provide definitive proof that CREB was the bottleneck here.
They did. It was a really powerful experiment. The researchers genetically modified the flies to cause an overexpression of the CREB protein.
So they were basically flooding the system with this switch molecule.
Exactly. They were overriding the natural biological timing requirement. And when they did that, the masked training, the cramming, suddenly started producing long-term memory.
Wow.
It conclusively showed that CREB activation is the rate-limiting step. It's the bottleneck for forming permanent memories. And spacing is just the natural strategy the body uses to get around that bottleneck.
So cramming doesn't give the molecular machinery the downtime it needs to activate CREB and start building the proteins for a permanent memory trace.
It just doesn't. You can't rush it.
Okay, so spacing creates the opportunity for CREB to do its job. But the brain must have some kind of internal clock that signals when the best time for that next repetition is.
It does. And that internal clock involves our second molecule. It's called MAPK.
MAPK.
Right. Mitogen-activated protein kinase. And MAPK acts as the timing mechanism. It's what dictates the ideal window for that critical second exposure to the material.
So how did they figure out its role as a timer?
The studies use something called induced depolarization, which is essentially just creating bursts of neural activity to simulate what happens during learning.
Like a little jolt to the neuron.
Exactly. And they found that 4 spaced 3-minute depolarizations, each separated by a 10-minute rest period, was enough to trigger persistent lasting activation of MAPK.
Okay, so that's the space models. What about the crammed model?
Well, when they collapsed those 4 pulses into one continuous 12-minute burst of activity, the molecular equivalent of cramming the persistent activation failed completely.
That feels so counterintuitive. So if I just study for 12 minutes straight, it's basically useless for long-term memory. But 4 3-minute bursts with a 10-minute break in between is the key.
It does feel counterintuitive because it feels less productive, right?
Yeah.
But the research points to this roughly 45-minute temporal window after you first learn something where MAPK activation peaks.
So there's a sweet spot.
There's a sweet spot. If the second trial, your second review, falls within that window, the reinforcement of the memory is optimized. If you review too soon, the synapse is sort of saturated already and it's ineffective.
And if you review too late?
If you wait too long, the initial neural changes have already started to decay too much. So the spacing effect on this scale of minutes and hours is really about perfectly calibrating to this internal molecular clock.
Okay, so we've got the cellular clock down. CREB and MEPPK are running the show on the scale of minutes and hours.
Mm.
But spaced repetition apps, they schedule reviews for days, weeks, even months from now. That requires a much larger system inside the brain. What's keeping that clock running?
And that's the perfect transition to the systems level mechanism. This is called the hippocampal cortical transfer model.
Okay.
And this is the key to understanding why the optimal intervals have to expand over time, why they go from minutes to months.
I think I've heard the analogy for this. It's like 2 different hard drives in your brain.
That's a great way to think about it. Your brain has 2 memory storage systems that work on different timelines. First, you have the hippocampus. Think of that as the fast learning but temporary hard drive. It just quickly gobbles up and encodes all new information.
Like a RAM stick or a scratch pad.
Exactly. Then you have the neocortex. That's the big, wrinkly outer layer of your brain. And that is your slow learning permanent archive. It's where consolidated long-term knowledge lives.
So when I learn a new word or a new fact, it goes immediately into that temporary drive, the hippocampus. But the long-term goal is to get it filed away permanently in the neocortex archive.
Precisely. And the process of making that memory permanent involves gradually transferring the memory trace from the temporary hippocampal store to the permanent archive in the neocortex.
And that transfer process, that's consolidation.
That's consolidation. And it is inherently slow. It happens mostly over days and weeks. And critically, it relies on periods of rest and especially sleep.
Which is why you can't just binge learn a new language in a weekend, no matter how much you want to. The system is designed to prevent that kind of rapid data transfer.
It is. During certain stages of sleep, particularly non-REM sleep, the hippocampus repeatedly replays the information you learned that day to the neocortex.
Like a background transfer process.
It is. And this replay helps integrate the new memory into your existing network of knowledge. But crucially, you cannot rush this transfer with conscious effort. You can't just cram more material in. Time, measured in days and weeks, is essential for this filing process.
And that's why your SRS has to space reviews out
right.
across weeks and months. It's respecting this biological transfer speed limit.
Exactly.
And we now have new neuroimaging research, I think from 2025, that gives us tangible proof of this. We can actually see spacing affecting this integration process.
Yeah, a very compelling fMRI study. It compared participants using spaced versus masked learning, and then it tracked their memory all the way out to a one-month delay.
And they were looking at a specific brain network.
They were. They focused on the default mode network, or DMN. That's a set of connected brain regions that we associate with, you know, introspective thought and integrating broad knowledge.
So what was the difference in brain activity between the two groups?
They found that the spaced learning group showed significantly higher neural pattern similarity in parts of their DMN during the immediate retrieval test.
So their brains were processing the information differently right from the start.
Right. Compared to the masked learning group, it means that spaced practice immediately started engaging the parts of the cortex that are associated with your broader, permanent knowledge networks.
So the implication is, if you cram, the memory stays isolated in that temporary storage in the hippocampus.
Right.
But if you space it out, your brain immediately starts the process of filing it away into your permanent knowledge library.
That is the practical takeaway, and here is the really powerful part. This higher neural pattern similarity, this early integration into the permanent archive, that was the exact factor that predicted which memories would be durable and persist all the way to the one-month delay.
Wow. So spacing isn't just about repeating something. It's about facilitating that gradual reorganization and integration of the memory.
It is. And if you skip those time intervals, you're just forcing the hippocampus to hold on to data it's biologically designed to get rid of, which leads to inevitable forgetting.
Okay. So the biology is crystal clear. Spacing is required. Now, how do we use math to perfectly calculate those expanding intervals? This is where the algorithms come in.
And the history here is fascinating. It didn't start in some big university lab.
Right. It started with one person's self-experimentation.
The foundational work that basically launched the entire SRS industry came from the personal experiments of Piotr Wozniak in Poland, starting back in 1985. He was just meticulously tracking his own ability to recall things he'd learned.
He was his own research subject. He was crowdsourcing his own brain data before that was even a concept.
He was. And his first algorithm, which he called SM0, was based on a really simple rule that he observed in his own data.
Which was?
The optimal intervals for him to successfully recall something seemed to approximately double with each successful repetition.
So one day, then 2 days, then 4, 8, 16, and so on.
Exactly. It's fascinating that this intuitive doubling rule, which a lot of people still use as a mental model today, just emerged organically from his personal tracking.
It turned out to be a really powerful starting point.
A very powerful heuristic. And by 1987, Wozniak introduced SM2. That stands for Super Memo Algorithm 2.
And this is a big leap forward.
It was the first major advancement that went beyond that fixed doubling. SM2 introduced adaptive matrices and, crucially, the concept of the ease factor, or EF.
Okay, what does the ease factor do?
The EF let the algorithm adjust the interval based on how difficult you, the user, found the specific item. When you review a flashcard, you grade yourself. Easy, good, hard, or fail.
Right.
If you marked an item as easy, the algorithm would increase the ease factor for that card, making the next interval expand much faster. If you marked it hard, the EF decreased, slowing down the expansion.
So it personalized the schedule for every single card.
Card by card, yes. And here's the truly astonishing part of this story. This 38-year-old algorithm is still the default scheduling foundation for almost every major customizable SRS platform today.
Including the ones the power users love, like Anki and Mnemosyne.
The very same ones. It's this simple set of rules from the 80s that's delivering that massive 74% gain over cramming.
So if SM2 is this like ancient, incredibly robust workhorse, what's happening on the algorithm frontier today?
Today it's all about FSRS.
FSRS. That's the free-spaced repetition scheduler.
Correct. And this is where we see machine learning and really complex statistics being applied to try and squeeze out the absolute last drops of efficiency from the scheduling
It's
process.
a significant modernization of the whole approach.
It is. The latest implementation, FSRS 6, is rolling out across the Anki ecosystem as we speak.
So what's the fundamental difference between FSRS and the SM2 math that's worked so well for almost four decades?
The key difference is in how it models human forgetting. Older algorithms like SM2 often use simple exponential forgetting curves.
Okay.
FSRS uses a more sophisticated model. It's called a power function forgetting curve. And extensive analysis shows that the way humans actually forget things over time really does follow a power law.
So the math in FSRS is just a better, more realistic fit for the data of our leaky brains.
It's a much superior empirical fit, yes. And on top of that, FSRS is a highly personalized, trainable system.
It's not just using that simple ease factor.
No, it tracks three core metrics for every card. Retrievability, which is the probability overcall it. Stability, which is how long until that probability drops below a target, usually 90%. And difficulty.
And it optimizes all of that using machine learning.
Yes, with 21 trainable parameters that are constantly tuned using your entire personal history of every successful and failed review you've ever done.
It sounds incredibly precise. I know they benchmark this across millions and millions of reviews.
The results are quantitatively very impressive. FSRS was tested against 727 million reviews from about 10,000 Anki users.
A massive data set.
And in that benchmark, FSRS 6 achieved a log loss of 0.3460 that was significantly better than the 0.4694 achieved by, for example, Duolingo's proprietary HLR algorithm.
Okay, let's stop there. We need to define log loss for our listeners. What does that actually mean in this context?
Right. Log loss is a metric for evaluating a prediction model. Conceptually, a lower log loss just means the algorithm is less wrong when it predicts whether you're going to pass or fail a review.
So a log loss of zero would be a perfect prediction.
A perfect crystal ball, yes. The fact that FSRS has a much lower log loss confirms that, mathematically, it is far superior at predicting when you are going to forget something compared to older models.
Okay, that sounds like a decisive victory then. FSRS is demonstrably better at prediction. But here's the question. If I know exactly when I'm going to forget something, why doesn't that automatically translate to dramatically better long-term learning? Isn't perfect scheduling the entire point?
And that is the critical insight that gets lost in this whole algorithmic arms race. We have to draw a bright line here.
The distinction being.
Prediction accuracy is not the same as actual learning outcomes.
And say that again.
Prediction accuracy is not the same as learning outcomes. While FSRS is a better predictor of forgetting, the sources point out this profound gap in the research. There are no rigorous, peer-reviewed, head-to-head trials showing that these sophisticated parameter-heavy algorithms like FSRS produce meaningfully better real-world retention over months or years compared to just using a simpler, well-applied algorithm like SM2.
So we've spent all this time and energy using advanced math and machine learning to optimize the schedule to the nth degree. But it turns out the math wasn't the real problem.
It leads directly to this idea of diminishing returns. The sources show that the marginal gain you get from moving from a fixed schedule to a more adaptive one is, it's tiny, approximately 3% better outcomes.
And 3%.
Only 3%. The massive transformative benefit is the 74% improvement you get simply from spacing at all. Once you're in that zone, the algorithmic sophistication is an engineering marvel, but it has a negligible practical payoff.
The bottleneck isn't the scheduling math.
The bottleneck is human adherence, the quality of your learning materials, and the transfer of knowledge to the real world, which we're going to get into.
So the fancy algorithms might not be the silver bullet, but that doesn't mean all algorithmic thinking is useless. There's a foundational principle that came out of that huge 2008 meta-analysis by Sapieha and his team.
Yes, that study, with over 3,350 participants, established the principle of proportionality.
Which means?
It means that the optimal spacing schedule is always proportional to your desired retention interval.
So the algorithm shouldn't just be aiming for some abstract 90% retention rate.
No. It should be scheduling your reviews based on how long you, the user, actually need the memory to last.
And that is a devastating critique of how most apps are designed. I mean, if I'm cramming for a test that's tomorrow, my optimal schedule is completely different than if I'm trying to learn a language for the rest of my life.
Completely different. And the study even gave us specific ratios. If you have a short-term goal, like retaining information for 1 week for a final exam, the optimal gaps are actually pretty large, about 20-40% of that interval.
So you might only need to review a day or two before the test.
Right. The deep systems-level consolidation doesn't need to be complete. But if your goal is lifelong retention, say for a language,
which is what most people use these apps for.
Exactly. Then the optimal gap shrinks dramatically in relative terms. It's only 5-10% of that total retention interval.
So that means you need more frequent, more aggressive reviews in the first few weeks to really lock that information into the neocortex for the long haul.
You do. And this is the science to implementation gap laid bare. If the optimal schedule depends entirely on the user's subjective goal, which the algorithm can't possibly know,
then we have a systemic flaw.
It's a huge flaw. Most commercial apps just don't account for this. They operate on a default one-size-fits-all schedule.
Which means it's optimized for a hypothetical learner, not the actual person using it.
And that severely limits the effectiveness of even the most mathematically perfect algorithm.
Okay. So the science of spacing is solid. The algorithms are mathematically refined, even if the gains are diminishing. So why? Why are we still staring at a 99.9% failure rate?
The answer is in the collision between the cold, hard science of learning and the warm, messy realities of human psychology and consumer economics.
And we see this paradox perfectly expressed in the two leading approaches to SRS. You have Anki on one side and Duolingo on the other.
They represent two completely opposing philosophies on user control and friction.
Let's start with Anki. It really embodies this idea of a user-owned memory system.
Anki is a toolkit. Its whole philosophy is built on maximal customization, algorithmic transparency, and workflow efficiency.
It assumes you're a sophisticated, motivated user.
It does. It assumes you know how to create your own high-quality learning materials. It's a platform for your memory. It's not a curriculum guide.
And that's why it has such a vibrant add-on ecosystem. It lets users adopt cutting-edge things like the new FSRS algorithm immediately.
Or tools like Anki AI Utils for helping generate cards. Anki maximizes learning efficiency for the people who are already initiated. But
the setup, the maintenance, all of that drastically increases the friction for a beginner. You have to be willing to really manage the system yourself.
Precisely. Now contrast that with Duolingo, which is all about being the guided experience.
Their whole philosophy is about eliminating friction.
Everything is about eliminating friction. You get a guided curriculum, you get strong visual gamification, and this intense focus on habit formation through things like streaks.
The system tells you exactly what to do next. It removes all of that decision paralysis.
And while that's great for getting people started, it creates a dependency. And we see a really powerful signal of this in the user demand for portability.
What do you mean by that?
There is an Anki forum thread titled "An Alternative to Memories to Anki." It has over 100 replies and has been viewed almost 9,000 times.
So people are trying to get their data out of these guided platforms.
They are heavily invested in the flashcard data they've created. And when a platform like that inevitably changes its business model or its features or even its algorithm, the fact that you can't export your personal data creates massive user anxiety.
So the market is basically screaming for the portability that an open toolkit like Anki provides.
It really is.
Okay, let's dig into the financial engine that's driving these guided apps, because it seems like the economics fundamentally sabotage the learning science.
The conflict is almost unavoidable in a free-to-play ad-supported model. Look at Duolingo's scale. It's massive. Over 500 million total users.
And over 100 million monthly active users.
Right. But their paid conversion rate is tiny. It hovers around 2%.
So 98% of their users aren't paying directly.
Which means revenue has to come from engagement metrics, from advertising exposure, or, as we'll get into, from monetizing failure.
So the business relies on maximizing daily active users, DAU, and critically, on maintaining streaks.
The streak is the golden metric. The data shows that users who maintain a 7-day streak are 3.6 times more likely to stay engaged long term.
So the app's internal algorithms, the notification systems, they aren't optimized for learning.
They are not. They are multi-armed bandit algorithms fine-tuned for engagement. They're designed to do things like push a notification to save your streak, not to maximize your long-term retention of the material.
And this creates that direct conflict with the science. Learning science, guided by this principle of desirable difficulty, suggests that shorter, less frequent sessions are often optimal.
Exactly. The science demands a little bit of struggle, a bit of friction.
But the business model demands the exact opposite. It wants you to come back every day, stay for longer sessions, and experience as little friction as possible.
And that incentive pushes the system towards things like matching games or multiple choice questions, these shallow review loops, because they feel easy. They keep you in the app longer, which maximizes ad revenue and the DAU metric.
So you leave the app feeling good, feeling like you accomplished something.
Even if you learned very little, that will actually stick.
And then there's the really controversial part, the Duolingo heart system, which seems to explicitly monetize mistakes.
That heart system draws a direct line from a pedagogical failure to a financial gain for the company. When you make mistakes, you run out of hearts.
And you can't continue practicing.
Not unless you purchase more hearts with real money or you sit through a video ad. And this creates a really problematic incentive structure.
The tool might be financially optimized to gently nudge you towards making mistakes.
Or at least toward content that slows your progress in order to drive revenue, rather than being purely optimized for your efficient long-term learning.
And a 2021 systematic review published in Taylor and Francis looked at Duolingo's effectiveness in light of all these design choices.
Yeah, and the review concluded with what it called a mixed and sometimes negatively skewed picture of its effectiveness.
What were the main criticisms?
The authors noted that once the novelty of the app wears off, the gamification just can't compensate for design decisions that prioritize repetition over meaningful feedback.
And they favored certain types of skills over others.
They did. The design heavily favors passive receptive skills, like reading and listening, over the difficult, high-friction act of active, productive skills, like speaking and writing.
So even 8 years into the platform's existence,
the review stated there was still very little conclusive evidence about its effectiveness, despite its immense scale. The economics of engagement are clearly winning out over the science of learning.
This business model failure is a recent thing, though. The failure to adopt spacing is a historical tragedy that predates the smartphone by more than a century.
That's a powerful point from Frank Dempster's 1988 paper. It was called The Spacing Effect, a case study in the failure to apply the results of psychological research.
And he was looking at formal education.
Yeah, he noted that despite the spacing effect being one of the most robust findings in all of experimental psychology, American classrooms and textbooks had just ignored it for decades.
And he had a very counterintuitive finding about textbooks from different countries.
He did. He noted that Soviet mathematics textbooks at the time actually provided more distributed presentation of concepts than their American equivalents. The spacing was built in.
So why do we, as institutions and as individuals, consistently ignore a scientific finding that delivers a 74% retention boost?
It comes down to a cognitive bias.
It does. It's called the judgments of learning paradox. And this is the core metacognitive barrier that just cripples self-directed learning.
Can you break that down? When students cram, they're doing masked learning. And that produces stronger performance on an immediate test.
Because the information is right there, active in your working memory.
Exactly. It's fluid. And that effortless recall gives you this strong, immediate sense of accomplishment and fluency. You feel like you're learning effectively.
But that feeling of fluency is an illusion.
It is entirely deceptive. Spaced practice, on the other hand, forces you to retrieve the information after a delay. It requires significant effort.
That desirable difficulty we talked about.
The very same. It's required for long-term storage. But because it feels difficult, learners incorrectly interpret that struggle as a sign that the learning method is ineffective.
So we trust our subjective feeling of fluency over the objective reality of what actually works.
We do, and the numbers on this preference are just shocking.
What did the studies find?
In controlled studies, 83% of participants rated masked practice cramming as equally or more effective than spaced practice.
Even though spacing produced objectively superior retention in those very same people.
Yes. They literally choose the method that makes them feel better in the moment, even when they know, intellectually, it delivers worse results in the long run.
And our institutional structures just make this problem worse.
They amplify it. Curriculums are designed around immediate assessment, like unit tests, not long-term retention. Textbooks are organized into these neat, separate chapters that discourage spaced review. There's just a general institutional inertia.
It's just too hard for a teacher or a student to arrange it on their own.
It's beyond what any teacher or student can reasonably arrange, according to the researchers, at least without technology. And the apps were supposed to solve that scheduling problem.
But they created a whole new failure mode instead, a logistical one.
The review burden dropout catastrophe.
This is the mechanical failure of SRS.
Yeah.
The system is beautiful when you stick with it, but the moment life gets in the way, a sick day, a busy week, the system turns against you.
This is the single most common reason for burnout among even the most dedicated Anki users. The system schedules future reviews. If you skip a day, all of those scheduled reviews just pile up.
And they pile up exponentially. The volume becomes insurmountable very quickly.
The sources give a really concrete example of this. Let's say you're a diligent learner. You start day one with 50 reviews to do.
Okay, manageable.
But you skip that day. Well, those reviews, plus the new ones that were scheduled to appear, mean that on day two, you're now facing 120 reviews.
That's more than double.
And if you skip day three, you're facing 190. By day four, you log in and you are staring at a list of 280 reviews.
It's almost a six-fold increase in just 3 days. That pile, it doesn't feel like a learning opportunity. It feels like a failure.
It feels like a punishment. It creates an impossible cognitive load. And the sources are clear. The number one mistake people make is learning too many new cards per day. It leads directly to this unmanageable pile that drives people to burnout.
And this connects right back to that psychological challenge of immediate effort versus delayed reward.
It does. Cramming gives you that immediate, tangible sense of accomplishment. You feel good right away. But the huge retention benefits of SRS only show up weeks or months down the line.
So in that crucial initial period, you're basically running on faith in the science, not on your own personal experience of success.
Which undermines persistence for most people.
So how do these successful users, the ones who stick with it, how do they get over this massive psychological and logistical hurdle?
They establish a strict persistence threshold and a rigid daily routine. They're advised to limit new cards to maybe 10 or 20 a day, max.
And they always do their reviews first.
Always complete your due reviews before you even think about adding new material. And keep the sessions short and manageable, 15 to 30 minutes. Consistency is everything.
And the data backs this up.
It does. Users who practice consistently for 3 months are 4 times more likely to achieve their language learning goals. The key is just surviving that initial delayed reward period by maintaining consistency and avoiding that exponential backlog.
Okay, so we've covered the failures of business models, bad metacognition, and logistical burnout. But let's imagine a perfect user, someone who is diligent, sophisticated, masters 20,000 flashcards. They still might not be able to hold a conversation.
And that brings us to the final and maybe most critical failure point. The transfer crisis.
The gap between knowing a fact and actually being able to use a skill.
This is the recognition production gap. And it's the sobering truth that complicates all those huge effect sizes we see in the SRS research.
Right, that Kim and Webb meta-analysis confirmed huge vocabulary gains from SRS.
It did. Effect sizes of G1.04 to 2.34 are massive. But the authors themselves issued a critical warning. The majority of those studies focused on what's called paired associate learning.
And that's just the classic flashcard format, right?
Exactly. Pairing one thing, like the foreign word Hund with its translation, dog. And the problem is when you test someone's ability to recognize that pairing, it's a fundamentally different mental process than asking them to produce the word spontaneously in a sentence.
And the research now is suggesting these might be two completely distinct abilities.
Yes. Recent theoretical arguments are suggesting that recognition and what's called lexical recall are potentially distinct psychometric constructs. They use different neural pathways, they require different kinds of training.
And the practical outcome of this gap is what you call the illusion of knowledge.
Precisely. One study found that, yeah, vocabulary knowledge explains a lot of the variance in speaking ability. But, and this is the crucial part, learners with large vocabulary sizes did not necessarily produce lexically sophisticated L2 words during speech.
So you recognize thousands of words on your flashcards. You feel like you're fluent.
But the moment you have to actually speak, that knowledge is revealed as shallow and inaccessible under pressure.
So why? Why does the knowledge fail to transfer from the comfortable Anki app to the stressful real world? The sources give us 4 different theoretical explanations.
The first is proceduralization failure. This comes from skill acquisition theory. The declarative knowledge, the isolated facts that SRS is great at building, it has to be transformed into proceduralized, automatic knowledge.
The kind you need for speaking.
The kind you need for any rapid, spontaneous action. Flashcard review is slow, conscious, controlled. Conversation is fast, unconscious, automatic. That transformation requires production practice, which SRS alone does not give you.
Okay, what's the second explanation?
Transfer appropriate processing. This principle says that your memory retrieval works best when the cognitive processes you use during training match the ones you use during retrieval.
And they don't match here.
Not even close. The mental process of looking at a flashcard and recalling a single word does not match the incredibly complex process of having a conversation, which involves grammar, message formulation, and rapid switching, all under intense time pressure.
The third explanation is about the environment itself. There's a classic experiment here.
The scuba diver study. Context-dependent memory. The Godin and Battley study had scuba divers learn lists of words either underwater or on land.
And then they tested their recall in the same or opposite contexts.
Right. And they found that words learned underwater were recalled significantly better. Underwater.
The implication for SRS being?
The implication is that words learned in the very specific, abstract, low-context environment of a flashcard app might not activate at all when you're in a loud, dynamic, real-world context trying to speak to another human being.
And the final point is about the lack of pressure.
Yes, the absence of communicative pressure. Flashcards give you all the time in the world to retrieve the answer. A real conversation imposes severe, immediate time constraints. SRS doesn't train your brain to perform under that kind of real-time load.
So if the technology is optimized for the wrong thing, for recognition, and has this huge transfer gap, how do successful language learners, the polyglots, how do they actually use SRS?
The consensus among experts, even those with very different methods, is unified on this point. SRS is used as a supplement, never as a replacement for authentic language interaction.
So they have different philosophies, but they end up in the same place in practice.
They do. You have someone like Steve Kaufman, who speaks over 20 languages. He sees SRS as optional. He prioritizes massive amounts of reading and listening. Comprehensible input is king.
Okay.
Then you have someone like Gabriel Weiner from the Fluent Forever Method who puts SRS right at the center of his system. But, and this is key, he emphasizes the creation of very rich, personalized cards, which requires a lot of user effort.
So regardless of where they start, they converge on a few key points.
The convergence points are critical. One, SRS must be supplemented. Two, creating your own cards is vastly superior to using pre-made decks. And three, too much SRS leads to burnout, and it has to be strictly moderated.
That moderation idea suggests there's a heuristic for how much time you should spend on it.
There is. And while the sources say controlled trials on this are frustratingly sparse, there is a clear practitioner wisdom that's emerged.
And what's the rule of thumb?
It's an inverse relationship between your proficiency and your SRS time. Beginners should dedicate a good chunk of their time, maybe 30-40%, to SRS to build that foundational vocabulary.
But as you get better.
As you become an intermediate learner, that should drop to 20-30%. And for advanced learners, it should be 10-15% or even less. The vast majority of your time has to shift to authentic, contextualized input and output.
And we have data showing that other activities, like reading, are just as effective for building vocabulary.
We do. A meta-analysis on extensive reading found effect sizes for vocabulary gains that were comparable to those for SRS. It reinforces this idea that SRS is one powerful tool in a much larger system. It's not the whole curriculum.
So let's use that reconciliation metaphor to tie this all together.
SRS builds the vocabulary floor. You can think of it as building the cup. It gives you the basic knowledge you need to start understanding the language.
But you need more than just the cup.
Comprehensible input reading, listening, conversation, that is what fills the cup with water. That's what's needed for true fluency and automatic acquisition. If you only focus on building the perfect cup with SRS, you've just created a perfect framework for an empty skill.
Okay, so if the transfer failure is because the learning is too abstract and decontextualized, the solution has to be making the flashcards themselves richer.
That's the core design trade-off. We need to move from simple word cards to sentence cards.
Because sentence cards teach vocabulary and grammar at the same time in a functional context.
Exactly. An isolated word is abstract. And it's hard to remember abstract things. Sentences provide that vital context.
But the downside is that they're slower to review.
They are. They're about 2 to 4 times slower than simple word cards. So the key to making them efficient is a practice called sentence mining.
Which means creating cards from authentic content you're already consuming, like books or TV shows.
Right. And you have to adhere to the 1T sentence principle.
Okay, let's be clear. What is the 1T principle?
One target. You only create a card from a sentence where you understand everything except one single target element. That could be a new word, a new grammar structure, an idiom. This maximizes the learning efficiency of that slower review.
And beyond just context, we can also bring in visuals and creativity.
Yes, we need to leverage dual coding. Paivio's research shows that activating both verbal and visual processes in your brain helps with retention.
And the sources are all consistent on this next point. The most effective learning tool is the one you build yourself.
Self-generated mnemonics always outperform provided ones. The critical takeaway here is that the effort you put into creating the card is not a waste of time. It is a fundamental part of the learning benefit itself.
Which brings us to the latest frontier, AI integration. Because AI should theoretically solve this friction problem. It should make creating rich, contextualized cards trivial.
The capability is definitely here now. Tools like GPT-4 are being integrated, especially in the Anki ecosystem, for generating sophisticated flashcards from PDFs or articles. It's a massive leap in potential efficiency.
But the adoption isn't what you'd expect.
No. The quantitative signal we have reveals a profound barrier that has nothing to do with the AI's capability.
What's the signal?
A survey of medical students quoted on forums claimed that 53% of them would use ChatGPT to generate Anki cards if tutorials existed.
That is stunning. The AI can do the work, but the users don't know the workflow.
Mm-hmm.
The barrier isn't the technology's sophistication.
It's the lack of knowledge distribution, workflow friction, and accessible tutorials.
So the current innovation is all concentrated in better scheduling algorithms like FSRS and better automation with AI.
But the biggest barrier to widespread high-quality SRS adoption now is demonstrably tutorial availability, workflow friction, and paywalls that lock advanced features away. The ultimate solution isn't just a better algorithm, it's a better system for teaching people how to create and manage the high-quality, contextualized material that actually transfers to the real world.
All right, let's pull it all together. Let's synthesize the key findings from this deep dive into the paradox of spaced repetition.
I think there are three main takeaways, balancing that profound scientific success with the catastrophic systemic failure.
What's the first one?
First, the biological requirement is absolute. The spacing effect is the single most robust finding in learning psychology, and we know the molecular mechanisms like CREB and EPK that make cramming physiologically inefficient for long-term memory.
You simply cannot cram your way to durable knowledge.
You can't. Time is a required ingredient for molecular synthesis and for that systems-level consolidation to happen.
Yeah, takeaway number two.
Second, algorithmic perfection hits diminishing returns. Modern systems like FSRS are getting incredibly good at predicting forgetting. We see that in the superior log loss scores.
But that improved prediction doesn't translate to significantly better long-term learning outcomes.
The marginal gains are tiny, only about 3%. The real failure isn't the math, it's the transfer failure. And it's that underlying conflict between the business model that demands engagement and the learning science that demands desirable difficulty.
And the third and final takeaway.
Third, flashcard mastery is insufficient. Success requires treating SRS as just one component of your learning system. Optimally, it should only consume about 10 to 30% of your total study time.
The rest of the time has to be spent on other things.
It has to operate within a holistic system that prioritizes rich, contextualized input and active production practice. That's the only way to successfully bridge that recognition production gap. If you rely only on flashcards, you're perfectly optimizing a mechanism for passive recognition while completely failing to build the procedural skill you actually need.
Which leaves us with the final provocative thought for you to take away. The research consistently shows that the study techniques that feel easiest, cramming, rereading, passive consumption, are the least effective for long-term memory. And the techniques that feel difficult spacing, effortful retrieval, challenging production, are the most effective.
So what does that demand of your personal approach to learning?
How do you consciously redesign your own feedback loop to trust the objective, hard science of desirable difficulty over your own subjective, comforting, but ultimately flawed feeling of immediate learning fluency? That is the personal threshold that the paradox of SRS forces every dedicated learner to cross.
Find full research in sources at research.yuda.me, that's yuda.me,